Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I will be your host today. And today I'm speaking with Gökten Doğangan, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Middle East Technical University in Northern Cyprus. We'll be talking about her 2019 book, Gender Politics in Turkey and Russia, From State Feminism to Authoritarian Rule. Dr. Doğangan, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining me today.
Hello, Mrs. Dehanova. I'm glad with your invitation, actually. I'm glad that, I am given this chance to talk about my findings in the book.
Yeah, I'm very excited we could talk about this because, as I mentioned when I sent you my email to invite you to the podcast, this is very close to my own area of research as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to start us off, can you talk a little bit about your research background and sort of how you chose this topic and how the book came to be?
Oh, yeah. I have always an interest in gender equality, but my first encounter with the issue of gender equality in Russia took place when I went to Russia as an Erasmus exchange student to learn Russian. And I realized that Russian and Turkish women have similar problems, like traditional division of labor, domestic violence, and discrimination in the labor market. Despite these countries having different cultural traditions and historical pasts, and despite Soviet Russia had a more liberal framework and compulsory employment policy. So at that time, I also had an interest in Russian modernization. And so I just brought all these issues together, and I have decided to make a comparison between Russia and Turkey on the basis of the relationship between gender equality and politics. And this experience in Russia drew me actually to think comparatively about the situation in gender equality in Russia and Turkey. And I started to think why in Soviet Russia state feminism did not change traditional family structure and gender roles. And then I went to USA to Michigan State University as a teaching associate. And over there were very significant scholars whose fields of interest are gender in Russia and Russian politics. And I had a chance to share my observations and discuss with them. So these talks also inspired me to take my research further. And by the time, actually, when I was thinking about a comparative research between Turkey and Russia, there were gradual signs of authoritarianism and a patriarchal revival based on traditional values. So there was a small literature emerging that time, and no one was quite sure what would be coming. And the data pointing to the restoration or revival of the patriarchal gender order had not yet emerged then. However, I have decided to go further with my research. It was my observation and intuition that gradually emerging authoritarianism would have serious effects on gender equality. Unfortunately, I was not wrong, and numerous data started to emerge while I was doing the literature review, collecting and analyzing and writing empirical data. And even after finishing my research, there were important developments regarding gender equality in Turkey. And I'd also want to give, want to say a few words about my research, actually. My research was founded on empirical data and secondary literature. I conducted expert in-depth expert interviews with academicians known national and international for their academic production and engagement in feminist movements and pro-gender equality efforts. And also, I have conducted interviews with the leading representatives of the long-term women NGOs and international organizations in Turkey and Russia, also with feminist activists and public officers. However, I should underline that I couldn't find a way to meet with the public officers in Russia or representatives of political parties. I could not arrange any appointment. I could not schedule an appointment with them. So with the public officers, I only talked in Turkey. So, I mean, this is the background of my research.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not surprising that they were resistant to talk in interviews, because I think especially on these topics, they're very worried about anyone who's considered outside of Russia writing about these things. So yeah. I've had these issues too, trying to get interviews.
Exactly.
So can you talk also a little bit about what theoretical frameworks you use in the book?
Sure. Actually, my conceptual framework consists of the pair of gender order and gender climate, which are coined by R.W. Connell and Rebecca Kay. So this conceptual pair enabled me to elaborate on the women's equality in Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey and gender equality in contemporary Russia and Turkey, while taking into consideration state as an embeddedly autonomous organization. So, I mean, with this conceptual pair, I managed to make a comparison between Russia and Turkey, a country comparison, but at the same time, I analyzed the historical trajectory in each case. I mean, how, for example, my main question is why this state feminism has turned into a state-promoted family and motherhood in contemporary Russia and Turkey. So this conceptual pair enables me to follow this historical trajectory in both cases. So what are these concepts? I mean, do you want me to elaborate on this conceptual framework a little bit?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, I should underline that I take state as an embedded autonomous organization, but while taking state as a starting point, I do not attribute state an essence. So, on the contrary, this conceptual framework allowed me to consider the mutual interaction between state and society. So, according to Connell, gender order is a historically constructed pattern of power relations between men and women and definitions of femininity and masculinity. And Rebecca Kay contributes to her framework with the concept of gender climate. So, in case understanding, gender order refers to the underlying norms and patterns about gender relations, while gender climate corresponds to the prevailing norms and patterns that regulate gender relations in a specific time. So, gender climate is the way in which gender order is packaged and presented at a given time in a given society. And at the same time, gender climate functions as a hegemonic discourse and praxis because it affects the ways in which it is considered acceptable to speak about gender. As such, gender climate provides the conditions for hegemonic domination at the practical level because it manages social perceptions and attitudes about gender on the basis of generally accepted values. So these values are meaningful to the majority of people, even though some of them may oppose or criticize the gender authority, gender ideology of the incumbent political authority. So gender climate builds up hegemonic domination at the social perception, and this encourages the transformation of the gender order in the direction of more egalitarian gender relations, as we see in the early 20th century in Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey. And or the gender order could be transformed towards the revival of the underlying gender order, which is identified as vital for national power and survival. So, in this framework, the state is constructive to this process and determines the interaction between gender order and gender climate, and manipulate the gender order in tandem with its sociopolitical and economic concerns and interests. So, from this conceptual framework, when the state and Soviet when the Soviet and Republican state had a modernization agenda, it led the already changing gender climate towards women's equality on the basis of state feminism. But then, in the 21st century, when the Russian and Turkish states have started to underline the national authenticity and culture against the moral authority of the West, against the implications of globalization, and in line with neoliberal economic policies, then these states have seen an interest in the underlying gender order in order to redefine national identity around a right-wing populist discourse. So, the interaction between gender order and gender climate shows us that gender dynamics play a constructive role in the political process. Political actors benefit from cultural meanings and symbols deriving from society-wide notions of femininity and masculinity. And these tools help the authorities establish strong ties and cultural resonance with the populace and secure their political support and legitimacy for their performance. So this conceptual framework also allows me to consider the implications of Soviet and Republican discourse and policies over the perceptions and praxis of women, which have manifested in the feminist movement and women's struggle towards gender equality. Because, I mean, this state, I mean, both states have an orientation towards state-promoted motherhood and family, but there is a growing resistance against these family-oriented policies of the states. Because, so gender order is also dynamic. It is not as same as the early 20th century, for example. So, because the Russian and Soviet and Turkish women have benefited from the state-led policies of women's equality. So, I mean, that is why this conceptual pair also enabled me to consider the implications of Soviet and Republican policies over the perceptions and praxis of women and over the orientation towards feminism on the ground.
So to develop a little bit more this idea of state feminism, can you talk a little bit about some of the concrete ways that women experienced greater freedom and autonomy at the start of these policies, both in Soviet Russia and in Republican Turkey?
What kind of policies were conducted, how legal framework was changed? These are very important to understand the implications of state-led women's equality or state feminism in Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey. First of all, let me talk about the legal framework, actually. So one of the first efforts of after the Bolshevik Revolution, actually, the revolutionaries, one of the first efforts of the revolutionaries was to change the civil code and penal code, and which were inherited from the Russian Empire. And according to the new civil code, for example, marriage was defined as a civil rather than a religious union. And in marriage, both sexes were entitled equal rights in the choice of residence, alimony, child maintenance, and women were allowed to use their maiden surnames, for example. Similarly, women were entitled equal rights in divorce and inheritance, which were limited by the previous civil code, actually. And in addition to this, the new state's discourse was based on the worker mothers, and women's economic independence and their employment was strongly supported by the Soviet state. So the Soviet state embraced the role of supporting working women's economic independence by providing public childcare and public cafeterias or public laundries, for example. However, I mean, I should mention at this point that when the Soviet state had economic problems, the first cuts happened in this field, in the public infrastructure, actually. And the burden of domestic work was put on the shoulders of women by limiting the capacity of public, not childcare, but public cafeterias and public laundries, for example. And another concrete efforts were observed in the labor code, and the equal pay for equal work principle and the obligation to work regardless of gender were adopted as the main principles. And as I mentioned, the Soviet state assumed public responsibility for childcare and domestic chores by setting up public cafeterias, laundries, and childcare centers. There were also some special articles for women on the basis of their role of motherhood, because the Soviet state has a concern to protect the productive abilities of women as well, to protect their health. And for example, an exemption from night shifts or overtime work or dangerous jobs for working women at the point of childbirth, or extended maternal leave or maternity benefits, for example. These were the concrete policies that the Soviet state followed. And also, women were provided with a wide range of educational and occupational options. They were encouraged to acquire new skills, values, orientations, and aspirations, in addition to their traditional roles, actually. And also, they were endowed with political rights as early as 1918. Including the right to vote and to be a deputy of the Soviets. So we observe a similar efforts in the Republican Revolution too. One of the first efforts of Republican revolutionaries was also replace the Islamic law, which is called Sharia, with a secular civil code. And because before the revolution, actually, the women were promised with the abolition of polygamy and equal rights of inheritance, divorce, and custody. And these, the rights in the family, the unequal situation of women in the family and their lack of rights, actually, in the family, was a concern of the Ottoman women's movement, actually, since the 19th century. So the Republican revolutionists promised women to abolish this unequal situation within the family life, actually. So with this new secular civil code, public segregation of women, polygamy, arranged marriages, and repudiation were abolished. And women were given the equal rights of inheritance, divorce, and custody. And the code established equality between the sexes before the law and identified women as equal citizens with men. Similarly, in the labor code, the equal rights of workers regardless of gender were guaranteed. However, there were also certain restrictions on women's employment in order to protect their reproductive function and the family unit. And as a result of these civil rights, the women became more visible in the public sphere, education and professional employment. And political rights were endowed on women later than Soviet Russia in 1930 and 1935. Respectively, they were given the suffrage and participate in local and national elections as political candidates. However, there is an important difference between the legal efforts in Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey, because the main source of women's oppression in Russia was taken as capitalism, the capitalist relations, and the oppression of women or subordination of women were the main problems and were considered as the main sources of women's oppression and women's inequality. But in Turkey, it was religion, actually. So that is why there was a more secular orient. I mean, in both countries, actually, the new codes were more secular, but in Turkey, there was a kind of much complicated situation because there was an orientation towards secularism, but at the same time, the women's morality, especially in the public sphere, was an important concern for the Turkish revolutionaries. So that is why, I mean, and the family was, women's employment, for example, was not put as a priority against the family life, or they were not put on the same level. For example, in the civil code, there was a, the women's employment and equal rights for employment were recognized, but women's work outside home was conditioned on the permission of their fathers or their husbands. So when we make a comparison between the Soviet and Republican law, we see that the Soviet law was much more liberal than the Republican law. So these are the actually concrete benefits and concrete conditions to women's emancipation and autonomy, but as I say, there were also certain limitations on women's equality.
Mm-hmm. And could you say a little bit more about the autonomous women's movement, its emergence, and particularly kind of its recent history vis-a-vis state policy?
Yeah, actually, women's movement had a background, had a past during the empire times, in the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. And so actually in Soviet Russia, the women's movement gained importance during the February Revolution, actually. And in the February Revolution, women resisted to the war, and they were screaming in the streets for decent work, for decent working conditions, and for bread, actually. So at this point, the Bolshevik leaders, on the one hand, realized that there was a very disturbed population, and this is half of the population, actually. There was a very disturbed group with the conditions in the Russian Empire, and for numerical reasons, actually, there was a need to mobilize and organize these women for revolutionary cause. And as a result of this, actually, the Bolsheviks integrated women's question as a part of their revolutionary agenda. And then, for example, they started to publish a journal called Robotnitsa, which means working woman in Russian. And also they established an office on an office for women's mobilization and women's organization. And then after the revolution, revolutionaries also, in order to sustain the women's support for the revolution and to make them benefit from the new legal framework, new legal rights in a better way, in a concrete way, they also encourage the establishment of specific women's organization, which is called Genotel. However, this specific Bureau for Women's Rights started to make feminist claims in time. And they demanded much more from the regime for improving the employment conditions of women or for providing them with much more material benefits, for example. So then the revolutionaries just got disturbed with this feminist voice, actually, the feminist direction. And they started to see this as a deviation because the revolutionaries were trying to abolish the class as a phenomenon that divides society. And now the gender constituted a risk for the revolution that could make the population to be aligned along their gender. So they were disturbed with the possibility of dividing the population along their gender, actually. And then in the 1930 or 31, the Genotel was closed because it was claimed that the women's question was solved and women's equality was achieved. We observe a similar trend in Turkey too, actually. And after the revolution, women's who were the representatives of the Ottoman women's movement and who supported the Republican Revolution for secularism and nationalism, actually, at first they intended to establish a political party. However, the authorities refused this interest, refused this idea, and then they were convinced for establishing a union, which is called Turkish Women's Union. And the expectation was the support for the new nation state and for secular order. Actually, when we look at the activities and discourse of the Turkish Women's Union, we do not see any challenge to the national and secular order, but there were some feminist demands, and there was a kind of, feminist critique of the new regime. And again, the newly established Republican state could not tolerate this feminist voice and made the union liquidate itself after the political rights of the women were entitled. So, again, the reason was the resolution of women's equality or women's question, and there was no need for a specific organization that represents the women's rights because there is no problem or there is no more inequality between men and women.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk in the book about how in the years leading up to the respective ascent of Putin in Russia and Erdogan in Turkey, there are certain shifts happening in sort of the way that in the policies and ideology of state feminism and then the discourse around them, right? So what are those shifts and how was this return to a more traditional family structure framed?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I should say that this shift has not started with Erdogan and Putin. Actually, from the very beginning, the revolutionary change in Soviet Russia and early Republican Turkey did not bring about a total rupture. State-led women's equality represented a reintegration of pre-revolutionary traditions with communist and secular nationalist premises in respectively in Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey. And from the very beginning, there were reactions, and these, I mean, the women's-led equality, or, I mean, sorry, state-led equality, or state feminism, was a part of modernization projects in Soviet Russia and Turkey. And so from the very beginning, in the political debates regarding the direction of modernization or westernization, controversial debates. And the debates were revolved, these debates, these political debates were revolving, particularly revolving on the role of women, on the rights of women. Because, I mean, as a part of modernization, there were some efforts needed to emancipate women, but at the same time, the revolutionaries or the reactionary groups against these revolutions were also concerned about the implications of revolution and implications of women's equality or women's emancipation on the society, on the morality, on public morality and social life, for example. So that is why, I mean, before the revolutions in both cases, the women's emancipation was a controversial topic. What should be its limits, or what should be its orientation, for example. So especially in Turkey, there was always counter-attacks against modernization. However, I mean, in both Soviet Russia and Republican Turkey, because the governing elite was so committed to communist and secular premises, and this revolutionary elite was highly organized at the decision-making level, then these counter-attacks or critics are somehow contained for long decades, actually. However, in Soviet Russia, for example, it was again the state which brought up this issue again in the 70s, and because of the declining birth rates and because of increasing divorces or single mother families, for example, or increasing rates of alcoholism, increasing rates of juvenile delinquency, for example, as a result of these problems, then the Soviet state generated an interest in women's question again. And at this point, for the first time, it was admitted that the women's question was not resolved. There were unequal relations between men and women, and women were in a subordinate position in the family, at home, in popular decision making mechanisms, and in labor market as well. However, I mean, the state did not adopt a feminist viewpoint. Rather, there was a tendency emerging that blamed the Soviet policies for over-emancipating women and for increasing the burden of women. And double burden of women, of Soviet women, actually became a question. And in the period of perestroika, for example, as a result of the increasing rates of unemployment, for example, because of the transition, not a complete transition, but a kind of modification in the economic system, then, you know, Gorbachev made his famous announcement, and he called women back at home. And after perestroika after the transition to post-Soviet politics, then there was a duality. The early post-Soviet state did not have a specific interest in women's question, but in the grassroots level or in the civil society, there was a duality against gender equality. there were also feminist organizations and feminist debates and feminist journals or feminist movement emerged, but there was a conservative reaction to these feminist orientation. And because, I mean, the female population was really overburdened and they were so tired. And as a result of the authoritarian policy, authoritarian Soviet policies, actually, they were in need of cared by men, actually, which was highly rejected in the Western feminism, for example. Similarly, in Turkey, and then for the first time in the post-Soviet period, for the first time, Putin raised this issue in 2006 with the introduction of maternity capital. And also, I should mention that there was a demographic crisis in Russia since the 1970s. So this also makes the women's equality as a concern for the state. And Putin actually brought this tradition, and he also, I mean, when he introduced the maternity capital, he realized the importance of demographic crisis as an alarming threat for Russian state and society. But on the other hand, he also realized that, unlike Gorbachev, for example, it is not possible to bring women back at home. Not only the culture, but also the economic realities would not allow this happen. Women, you know, I mean, would leave the labor market and become housewives. So he tried to find a solution to the double burden of women, and he tried to revive the Soviet notion of worker mothers, but he did this not from a feminist perspective, but from a nationalist and conservative perspective. And when the relations with the West got worse, actually, and when the there were reactions against Putin's rising authoritarianism in Russia, then Putin made a conservative turn at the beginning of his third term, actually. And then his policies on gender equality have become much more concrete. And he introduced new incentives, for example, in addition to, not incentives actually, certain limitations. For example, the abortion regime was changed and domestic violence is not recognized. I mean, there were some attempts to criminalized domestic violence, but because of the Orthodox Church or Orthodox groups, for example, because of the reaction, domestic violence was decriminalized, for example. So within this context, actually, there was a transition towards more patriarchal and conservative gender ideology. In Turkey, similarly, I mean, before talking about how this new patriarchy supports their political regime, I just want to talk a little about the situation in Turkey. In Turkey, similarly, there was a duality regarding women's equality and the reaction, and there was a conservative reaction from the very beginning, but they were just, these reactions were contained. And however, I should mention that in the early 80s, there was a feminist movement emerging in Turkey. And this feminist movement just criticized the Republican policies of women's equality for not removing patriarchal relations or for not resolving patriarchal relations. So they claimed that these feminist women claimed that the religious patriarchy was just replaced with secular patriarchy. And in the 1980s in Turkey, we experienced a very disastrous military intervention in the 1980s. And then in 1983, Turkey experienced a transition to democratic polities. And it's a question how in this authoritarian period feminist movement was allowed to flourish. The point is that because of the need for seeking out international prestige and international support, the post-military period was a period of transition to democracy and to civilian politics. So civil society was encouraged and NGOs were mushrooming, and environmental movement, for example, anti-nuclear protests and feminist movement were allowed to flourish in this period. And Turkey also became a part of the international organizations, the UN declarations, for example, the CEDAW, for example. So this also created an interest at the state level too. However, and in addition to this, the feminist movement was not taken as a threat to the regime as well. I mean, so the state, on the one hand, underestimated the importance of feminist movement, and on the other hand, the conservative group in the governments also tried to contain the feminist efforts at the state level. So, for example, the General Directorate of Women, States and Problems was established, but before that, a Council for Family was established in order to counter the feminist efforts, for example. So at the state level, there was a duality. And in the ground, in the civil society, there was a duality too, because political Islam was rising and the pro-Islamist political parties started to achieve power in local and national elections. And the pro-Islamist parties also involved religious or conservative women within their struggle, into their struggle, because there was a very secular policy against the veiled women. Veiled women were not allowed to enter university or other educational institutions and public offices with their veils. So many women, many religious women or veiled women were excluded from education and from employment in public offices, or they were forced to remove their veils, for example. So pro-Islamist parties involved these women and earned their support on the basis of their exclusion from the system, on the basis of the violation of their religious rights, for example. So there was a duality. So as a result of this, an Islamist women's movement emerged. We should admit that there was an Islamist. There were Islamist feminists too, but in time, the Islamist women's movement became only focusing on women's headscarves, for example. So the voices of the Islamist feminists started to become weaker in time, for example, and under the leadership of Erdogan, they were totally excluded from the system. So this is the background of the pre-Erdogan and pre-Putin periods regarding gender equality in Russia and Turkey. So they did not do, I mean, neither Erdogan nor Putin made something from scratch, actually. So there was a tendency in the civil society and at state level toward feminism and conservatism also. So there was a kind of competition between feminism and conservatism. So why these two leaders did not adopt a feminist perspective or feminist orientation, and on the contrary, they supported conservatism? Because they saw a political interest in the underlying patriarchal order. In order to In order to support their populist and authoritarian regimes, actually, these Putin and Erdogan actually Putin and Erdogan use gender politics or traditional gender identities and roles as a way, as a tool of connection and resonance with the society. So, I mean, by doing this, actually, they establish very close links with the society, and they put themselves as the real and moral leader of their society. Because it has some reasons. Because, I mean, in Russia, there was a reaction against the West. And this has a background in the 1990s, in the transition period in Russia. So many of the Russians feel themselves as subordinated against the West, as dominated by the West, for example. And there was a reaction against the unipolarity at the geopolitical level or economic power of the Western countries, and at the same time to the moral authority of the Western countries. So they were under threat. Their national culture, their national authenticity were under the threat of the Western powers, and at the same time globalization. In Turkey, the discourse of Erdogan is based on that the traditions and values of real people were disregarded by the secular and westernized elites, and the genuine people were excluded from the system, were marginalized, and they were not respected. So it is time to put these traditional values and norms to the front again. And so, based on these discourses, actually, these both leaders established themselves as the real and moral representatives of the nation and protectors of the national authenticity and their values against both foreign and domestic threats. So, and traditional values, family and women, are the primary values that represent and carry these shared values by the larger groups in Russian and Turkish society. And so they just constitute the borders of the national identity and underline these values, I mean the traditional values, family and traditional role of women, are used as the markers of the national identity to distinguish the national authenticity and superiority of the Russian and Turkish cultures against the Western values represented by the Western countries or represented by the secular and westernized elites in Turkey. So this is my analysis on the revival of patriarchy in relation to the rising authoritarianism.
Yeah, and I mean, something that's really interesting that I've looked at a lot in my own work is that, you know, Russia, I mean, I don't know if this is similar in Turkey, but in Russia, there's obviously this, as you said, this idea that Russia is protecting traditional values, not just in Russia, but it's sort of this global leader exactly. of protecting traditional values mm-hmm. against the West, and particularly the United States. And yet Russian conservative organizations are working with a lot of American Protestant organizations, and particularly in sort of the anti-abortion laws, just as an example, they're using a lot of the same legal frameworks and discourse that the American anti-abortion movement uses. Exactly. So it's a very kind of ironic situation right now.
Yes, I mean, in Russia, I should mention that this anti-gender orientation has a geopolitical background too. I mean, in comparison to Turkey, for example. In Turkey, it is much more a domestic issue. But in Russia, it is much more a geopolitical issue because Russia challenges the unipolarity after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which was established as the new global order after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So there is a kind of challenge against the Western domination in economic, geopolitical, and cultural terms. So Russia, especially with the rise of the gender equality or with the recognition of the LGBTQI rights, for example, in Europe, Russia says that or claims that, at least Putin claims that, the orthodoxy, especially orthodoxy, is corrupting in the West. And we are the, I mean, Russia is the real representative of the orthodox tradition, actually. And also orthodox church is supported because it is another tool to impose control, not only in Russia, but also in the post-Soviet space, especially in Ukraine, in order to unite, for example, the efforts to unite Russian and Ukrainian people under the common identity of orthodoxy, for example. So, I mean, it's not, I mean, gender is not a very, is not a one-dimensional or secondary or simple issue, actually. It is very complicated. And it has a political, cultural, social, and economic and geopolitical dimension. So, yeah, it is like that.
Yeah, definitely. So there's one kind of more specific question I want to ask, and then we'll wrap up. But you talk about in your analysis of contemporary Russian law, you talk about that there's a difference between gender neutrality and gender sensitivity. Mm-hmm. It's and I think this is kind of instructive, not for the Russian and Turkish context, but for the West as well. So what do those terms mean? And how is gender neutrality kind of insufficient to address some of these the discrimination that's happening under authoritarian regimes?
Yeah. Gender neutrality is a basic excuse that the Russian authorities use in order to not make a law on domestic violence. Because they argue that in our constitution and in Russian constitution and in other specific codes like civil code, penal code, or labor code, there is no discrimination against gender. They say that the language of law is gender neutral. So all articles are made on the basis of the women's equality between men and women. This is what they say. However, every social phenomenon is gendered. You can put an article in the labor law that you can say that there can be no discrimination against any individual on the basis of their sex. Yes, this is an important article, but this doesn't recognize the discrimination that women experience in the labor market because of their sex. So gender neutrality is based on abstract understanding of social phenomena, and this hides gender-biased rules, norms, and values. Every social phenomenon is gendered. Economy, politics, space, citizenship, and law is gendered. And we see this in the Soviet legal framework, for example. So the legal equality was ensured, was recognized, but the legal equality did not ensure the de facto women's equality. So, for example, in the Soviet law, the definition of family reflected certain inequalities and differences between men and women. In the contemporary Russian law, for example, the definition of family reflects certain inequalities and differences between men and women and assign women and men specific roles and identities. So, I mean, it is not convincing to say that the Russian law is gender neutral, because it is not. But as I said, this is an excuse to not convince, but to make a law on domestic violence or not to protect women in the labor market effectively. So gender, in my understanding, actually, gender neutrality refers to lack of specific rules and norms that ensure the equalization of men's and women's opportunities and the realization of their rights and freedoms. So there is a need for gender-sensitive rules and even positive discrimination by the state for the enforcement of specific rules and measures to enable women to realize their rights in an equal way, because legal equality is not sufficient. There should be some extra efforts to make women realize their rights, or to make them, both women and men, to benefit from the rights and freedoms in an equal way, or to benefit from the opportunities in an equal way. So gender neutrality reflects a kind of lack of awareness and is a kind of excuse for not issuing gender-specific laws against gender discrimination. And this has the effect of not recognizing specific forms of gender discrimination and then not protecting women. So as I said, these terms, the term of gender neutrality came up with the analysis of the lack of law on domestic violence, because a women's movement in Russia has been struggling for the enactment of law on domestic violence for more than 20 years. There have been attempts for more than 40 times, but none of them succeeded. And when the state denied the enactment of a specific law for mainstreaming gender equality, its main excuse is that Russia has an extensive and advanced legal framework, which is based on equality between sexes, and there is no need for a specific law on domestic violence, for example. And in the struggle with the domestic violence, the Russian state claims that there is penal code to criminalize domestic violence and punish the perpetrators. But when we look at practice, we see that the law enforcement bodies could not even find which article of the code applies to the case in question. Or, for example, the authorities claim that the law is gender neutral, but we see that, there is an article which prohibits sex-based discrimination in employment, but there is no parental leave, for example. There is maternal leave. So this reflects an assumption about gender roles and identities. So this is not convincing. So this proves that the laws, these articles prove that the law is gendered. But when the state says that the law is gender neutral, it says that the state does not assume any responsibility to protect women against any violations that derive from the gendered inequalities at home, in politics, or in labor market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think that goes really a long way towards explaining, for people outside of Russia, why this domestic violence issue continues to not be resolved and is actually kind of going backwards. Yeah.
Yes, it is treated as a part of traditional Russian family, not dangerous case of physical violence is not treated as a case of domestic violence sexual. For example, the small bruises or some claps, they are taken as a part of the relationship between the parents and the children, or between the spouses, for example. So, none of them, not women, or not only women, but also children, are not taken as individuals. So, men as fathers and husbands are given a right to control and even punish their children and their wives in case of a disagreement or in case of a conflict within the family, for example. And this is justified by referring to the traditional family structure. And this is the traditional family structure actually makes Russia very unique and different from the Western countries.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, what do you hope will be the key takeaways of your book for readers and listeners?
So what can be the main takeaways? So I can say that there's a feminist motto, private is political. But I say that political is private, political is private too. So politics is not that much far away, and it influences our experiences by gender, like class. So gender is not an issue of secondary importance. And in this book, I have tried to discuss how gender is constructed to politics in social, economic, political, cultural, and geopolitical terms. A second important takeaway could be the gender dimension of authoritarian politics, which is usually overlooked, actually. And I hope the readers, would would realize how the revival of patriarchy is integral to authoritarian politics and vice versa. By realizing this phenomenon, also as individuals or as the beneficiaries, we can also observe and give meaning to the implications of the combination of patriarchy and authoritarianism on our daily lives, on our experiences at home, in labor market, and at school, or even in the street, for example. So I think the relationship between authoritarianism and gender, understanding the relationship between authoritarianism and gender, is very important for us to realize what is happening in our private lives, what is happening when we are walking in the street or when we are working in a place, for example. Because, you know, I mean, especially in Turkey, the female murders is a very alarming social issue. And women are not secure and safe in the streets anymore, especially in night times, for example. Many women who are trying to get divorced from their husbands or get separated from their boyfriends, for example, they are under threat. We every day hear a case of female murder. So, in order to keep ourselves safe and secure, for example, so we should first understand the relationship between politics and gender, and then we should react this at more general level. And another important takeaway of my book is that the comparison, the importance of comparison. Actually, it is not only in Russia and Turkey, but across the globe, there is a tendency towards the revival of patriarchy. So even in the EU countries, for example, in Poland, in Hungary, we see that there is a tendency towards reviving the traditional patriarchal relations or limiting and restricting abortion rights, for example, or marginalizing or excluding the LGBTI individuals, for example. So that is why the comparative work between different cases such as Russia and Turkey helps us find out the reasons beyond the national borders. And as a result of these, thanks to this kind of comparisons, we can realize that, in the early 20th century, for example, it was a century for women's equality or at least liberal feminism. But in the 21st century, it is a time for authoritarianism, populism, and a revival of patriarchy. So these are the main takeaways that I can offer for the further readers.
Thank you. And I think that's extremely timely and important. And I really wish everybody would have some awareness of this. I like to ask guests, what are you working on currently?
Yeah, I'm still working on authoritarianism in Russia and Turkey from a gendered perspective. So now I am working on the political masculinity and its implications on the erosion of strong and durable institutions. Because the performance of masculinity by political leaders provides a symbolic cover and establishes a paternalistic relationship with the people. So power is so much personalized with Putin and Erdogan, and they present themselves as the patriarch of the nation. And this This provides them with certain benefits like increasing vote rates or increasing support. But now we see that these both countries are in a kind of economic and political crisis, and the popularity and support of not only the leaders but also their affiliated political parties are also decreasing. And there are many cases of corruption, for example. There is a lack of meritocracy. And these developments all point out to the erosion of institutions, actually. So especially, not only in Turkey and Russia, but across the globe, we realize the importance of the strong institutions for the consolidation or protection of democracy, actually, in addition to political culture. So at this point in my academic life, I want to focus on the implications of political masculinity over the weakening institutions. And so I just want to contribute to the operation of authoritarian politics from a gendered perspective.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Gökten Doğangan of Middle East Technical University about her 2019 book, Gender Politics in Turkey and Russia, From State Feminism to Authoritarian Rule, which is available from IB Taurus Press. Thank you for listening. And Dr. Doğangan, thank you again for joining me today.
And thank you for your invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to have this very nice talk. Thank you very much.